stick on it, check on it, stick on it. Help, help.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Well, it's good to be back with you here today. Since you're listening to this, I guess you didn't give up on me getting a podcast out this week. And to tell the truth, I'm having a hard time getting back in the groove after the past few weeks. You know, after taking almost a week to get my internet connection working again, I left town and spent a few days in the mountains doing some work with our little clan out here. And soon after returning home, my grandchildren and their parents came for a week-long visit. Now, after having so much fun with my children and grandchildren, sitting down in front of a computer for a few hours almost seems like work. But now that I'm here with you in the salon once again, I'm getting my second wind and getting back up to speed. So let's journey back to last week's program where I interview Gene and Myron Stolaroff about some of their experiences in the years past when they were actively engaged in psychedelic research. If you've seen that brilliant one-man show by Spalding Gray that he titled Swimming to Cambodia, you're aware of his concept of having a perfect moment on every trip that he took. Well, what you're about to hear is a conversation I had with Myron later that same day that, for me, was one such perfect moment. The interview that I played in the last program was recorded after lunch and was to have been our last recording session of that visit. But that evening, just as we began discussing dinner preparations, Myron pointed out the beauty of the light on the desert. And at the time, the sun was beginning to set, and while I had the best of intentions of helping Gene and Mary C. prepare our evening meal, I simply didn't have the willpower to leave the beautifully unfolding twilight scene outside. And once the sun had set and the sky turned dark, Myron and I began to talk about all kinds of things. After a while, I asked him if it would be all right for me to turn on my recorder, and he had no objection. But at the time, of course, I was afraid that I hadn't pressed the correct series of buttons to start my mini-disc recording. But there was just something special about that moment of dimming light that would have been lost had I turned on the lights to check out my equipment. But fortunately, the recorder worked. Now, the microphone level, it turned out, was a little too high, and so we also picked up the musical sounds of Gene and Mary C.'s conversation in the background. And while that may take a little away from what Myron is saying every once in a while, I hope it helps you feel like you are sitting right there with him and having a casual conversation in the gentle peace of twilight. Now, I realize that this conversation won't quite translate like that for you, but trust me on this. For me, it was a perfect moment.
You, with your background, you went to Stanford. You know, didn't you get your master's and bachelor's there?
I got a master's degree there.
Yeah, at Stanford. My God, you know. And then you helped develop the video tape system at Ampex.
Yeah.
So I've always wondered, you were really on a fast track there, and.
Oh, I've been lucky as can be.
How'd you feel about walking away from all that, though, to really pursue the expansion of consciousness? And
After I'd had LSD, I think there wasn't anything else that could come anywhere close to it. That was the most remarkable thing of my whole life. And even just the very first trial, it was so profound and so opening, and just dimensions of consciousness opened, and you think there's nothing else like this anywhere. There's anything else you can do to equal that.
Yeah, and so there's just no hesitation. You knew that was the path that you were.
Oh, absolutely. From the day that I took it.
Well, you were like one of the real early pioneers back there. That did you ever get to meet Huxley or any of those guys?
Oh yeah, I knew Huxley. I've met him several times. Once he actually visited us when we had this operation going in Menlo Park, and we were giving LSD to people. And one afternoon, he came in. He had stopped to visit some people at Stanford. Now, Stanford. There was a place, I forget what they call it. It was, I don't know whether Ford's maybe the Ford people had set it up, but there's
the
a place.
Institute?
Yeah, every year they would allow 50 people who were busy in management and different things, but they could take a 1 year sabbatical and they could investigate whatever they wanted, look into things and so on. And so that was all set there. And Huxley had gone over to look that over, and then he came to see us, and he didn't think very much of the other outfit, to tell you the truth.
So he actually did get to see your setup and meet with your staff.
Yeah.
So what was he like? Was he affable?
He's very affable. You know, he's tall and speaks very well. You know, he has trouble with his eyes somewhat. But by and large, you know, he's just a really outstanding person.
Friendly.
Extraordinarily wise. Friendly.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
It really is. And so he was, of course, one of the early pioneers back there at the same time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever stay connected with any of these other elders of the tribe, so to speak? Are there any left? Are you the last one standing?
Well, you know, after I got acquainted with Hubbard, I was really glued to him for a long time. You know, he was very smart. He knew how to take advantage of me. At the same time, I was delighted in all the things that he could provide for me. So I just had a ball with him. I was very fond of his wife. So we were good friends. I went there frequently. At least every year, I would go up and visit him there, and a lot of times on the island that he owned. But eventually, when he saw that we were really getting started with this, he moved down to Southern California, and I actually hired him. I paid him about $400 a month, I think, just as a consultant and to keep everything going and to keep him happy. And at the time, I had enough money that it didn't bother me.
You know, earlier you were talking about the carbogen. In your book, one of your books, you called it Meduna's mixture.
Meduna invented it. He's the one.
Oh, so that's the name of the person that...
Yeah. Yeah. And he was well known. He finally had about, I think, 200 doctors got interested and were using it. And it went on for a few years, and then I think it faded out.
Is Hubbard the one that brought it into use in the psychedelic movement?
Yeah.
He
saw Meduna face to face, and he saw what it could do. And then he had a policy. He had a really good friend who owned airplanes, and they were business planes of different kinds. And so Al was in close touch with him. And one of the things he would do, he would use that. See, long before I even knew about it, he would use that to make sure that all the pilots were in good shape. And, you know, if they were kind of getting uneasy or anything, he'd give them that. And they shaped up. Actually, I was there on the island one time, and two aviators flew over. I think they came together. They were able to land in the water there. And they both came to Hubbard, and they each took their treatment from him because, you know, they considered that after the length of time, you know, if they're getting uneasy or nervous or out of sorts or anything, they'd use that to kind of clear themselves and get a fresh start. So Hubbard had that pretty well under control.
Now, what was the experience like, an acid experience, or what was it like when you inhaled that?
Oh, gosh, it's hard to... Boy, you know, it covers a great round of stuff. One of the things I used to do... Hubbard just really got a big kick out of this. I go, fuck him! you know, at first I'd be going through all kinds of stuff. Sometimes it really hurt and was miserable, and then all of a sudden there'd just be an explosion of just letting go of stuff. And then a lot of times I'd feel a lot better after that.
Wow.
And then I had a very good friend who's a psychiatrist, and often I would go and have lunch with him in his home, and he would give me a treatment of that. And he did that. I think he did that for a couple of years. Finally said, Myron, you know, we're not getting any place with this. Now, I was getting all kinds of things. Gosh, I felt like at times that I was the wisest man in the world. I just saw practically everything going on. But a lot of times, you know, I was very uncomfortable because there was places, I guess, I didn't want to attack very well. But I kept going, and I'd feel very good for several days, and then I began to feel kind of out of it. And I'd go back. I was seeing him once a week.
Wow.
In his home. And I think I did it for a year, maybe 2 years.
This is then, during Ampex time?
Yeah. And then I said, Myron, you're not really getting anywhere. And he was right.
Well, fortunately, LSD came along. In Tantos Eros, you mentioned that you felt that LSD improved your piano playing ability.
Oh, no question.
Well,
no question.
See, I never even knew you played the piano. That was the biggest surprise, first of all.
Yeah. I said, one time in particular, I was under LSD and sat down and played the piano. I played like I had never played it. I didn't know I could play that well. It was wonderful.
Well, you know, it's like that no-hitter that was pitched on acid, the famous in the World Series, I think.
Oh.
I'm not sure I know about that. It was well documented that Larson, maybe, or whatever. But anyhow, he didn't think he was going to pitch that day, and he took LSD, and he got called up, and he pitched the only, like, no-hitter in the World Series or something. Only no-hitter for many years in the World Series, you know. But, you know, it was on acid, so kind of interesting.
So his performance...
greatly enhanced.
Yeah.
And again, that's a physical performance. Yeah. Whereas piano playing is a combination. Well, I guess baseball is an art as well. Mm-hmm. So being an engineer myself, I was really, you know, I loved it when you said something about you found that the engineers responded to LSD because they were, like, unusually sensitive to these substances. Mm-hmm. And I found the same about LSD. Is a very, to me, a good engineering kind of feel.
You know,
makes
me
feel secure.
Yeah, I had a number of people from Ampex. You know, they knew me well, and there's one time. Let's see. I think Hubbard was with us. Yeah, there's one time. Oh, you know, I wanted to work with these guys because I thought they'd all learn more and would be better engineers and everything. And the people at the head of the company, one person just sort of knew that I was doing something with these things, and they put a stop to it. And the people who were running the company didn't want me to do anything. But to hell with it, I put about, I think I got around 7 or 8 people, and with Hubbard, we all drove up to somebody's place way up in the mountains, and they all took something, and for most of them, worked out quite well.
And you know, at Menlo Park, because I've heard, I guess Jim Fadiman talk about
Fadiman,
yeah, talk about some of the results of the the architects and the people that had breakthroughs in business plans and all, and it seems like you had you were doing things a little different. It seemed to me in that you were looking at the creative end of the using it as a tool. Am I incorrect in that? Or?
Oh well, I think that's what it is. It's a creative thing, and it's an opener. It's a discoverer. You know, the people vary. I'm trying to think now. I think it was 7 or 8 people that went. And, you know, I knew them all well because we worked together at Ampex for several years. two or three of them had really great experiences, and I don't remember that any of them had a bad experience.
Why do you think so little attention has been paid to all this, pioneering work that was done there? I mean, do you think just as the drug laws made everybody kind of look the other way? Or?
Well, in terms of our company, the top people in the company already... See, I had approached them, and one of the high people with them, they were also connected with some of the doctors that are exploring LSD, and they didn't know what the hell they were doing. Out of the whole bunch, most of them had miserable experiences. There was one guy who was really very open and a real wonderful human being, and we became very good friends. But he really saw what it was all about. But a lot of those other people just had very unhappy experiences. They didn't get anywhere. They were psychiatrists.
But why do you think it is that for some people this is like a miracle drug, and for others it's something that they can't
It's follow. Because they're not willing to move into the repressed material inside. You see, and a lot of them, they've raised up to high levels of experience. They're important people. People come to them for help and so on, and they think that they know, but they don't know, and they're too scared. I mean, a lot of them tried it, and they had bad experiences.
Wow. So it's just,
Now, when I say a lot of them, I'm talking about a particular, specific group in Palo Alto where they had finally agreed that they would investigate LSD to a certain extent. And I think there was this one that I'd mentioned, and there was one other one that I knew. So I think there were two of them that sort of realized what LSD was, but the others would have nothing more to do with it.
In some of the experience reports that you have in your book, you talk about, doing it a new substance or something with a single partner, but also doing it in groups. That you seem to have had a lot of experience with several groups, small groups of people getting together. And
mm-hmm.
the reason I'm asking the question is that I found that a lot of the people in the dance community are kind of surprised to hear that you can do it in a small group, and they think it's only really for dancing. And so, so I just wondered if you had anything to say about the how it improves or whatever changes the experience if you're in a group that has met regularly or just friends that do it once a year or something, get together. Does that enhance the experience if considering doing it?
Oh, I think so. We really support each other. See, while we were doing this, with other people. There was a group, that we didn't want to talk too much about. But by and large, there's usually seven or eight of us, and we'd be maybe exploring with different substances. And sometimes it was unusually wonderful. Sometimes it wasn't so good. Some of the compounds weren't just interesting. I know one in particular, boy, I was really miserable. And I had a hard time sleeping that night. And that kind of broke through in the next morning. And then I think here, on my own, I decided to redo that because it seemed like there ought to be more to it. And so I did it alone here, and I think I got more benefit from it. But it's a little tougher than some of the other things. It's not one you'd want to pick out as your favorite.
Is there one you'd want to pick out as your favorite?
Well, I have several favorites. You know, one of my favorites is... it might have been 2CE. What did we
2CE we talked about. That's one I'm not even familiar with.
Yeah, that's a powerful one.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, I'd not heard of it until I saw it in your book. So one I'll have to keep my nose out for, so to speak. Since I had the pleasure of meeting you and Duncan Bluth, all at the same time, I loved the story about your first meeting with Duncan Bluth. And so I want to say a little bit about who he is and what his role in this whole thing has been, and anything you want to say about Duncan.
Well, Duncan is really an outstanding person. He's a psychologist, and he was teaching at the university in the central part of Canada. Well, let's see. Let me start with the beginning there. Hubbard would come over, and the older people there, Humphrey Osman, anyhow, they worked together. They were working with LSD, and they didn't really understand it very much until Hubbard came in and taught them more about it. And then one day Hubbard was visiting them, and he gave it to Duncan Bluth, and Duncan was having the time of his life. So he went in and he got the two guys and come in and says, "Hey, something's wrong with this guy. What is it?" And Duncan would just laugh and laugh. And they said, "Well, what's going on? What is?" And the more that came up, the more Duncan laughed. Because he saw the whole picture, a whole brand new picture. And he thought how ridiculous all this other stuff is. And so that was really quite something. I got to meet Dunn not too long after that because I was visiting Al quite a bit, and by this time Duncan and he got to be really good friends, so they'd come over and visit, and I'd caught up with him several times, and then Duncan even came all the way down to where we were doing our work in Menlo Park.
Oh, wow.
So he was around for a while. A wonderful human being.
So your first meeting, the very first time you met him, in the book you mentioned he was bounding up the stairs with a peyote button in his hand.
Right, right. And then and we all, one of the favorite things that I like to do, he belonged to the yacht club. Thank you. And so we were having dinner. And I think Doug passed around some stuff for us to chew. So he had some peyote, and he handed me a little, and I chewed it up. And it didn't feel very much, but then after it started getting active, it wasn't very powerful, just a small amount. But all of a sudden, everything just smelled so smooth and nice, and Duncan just felt so great being with him. And I looked around, everything seemed more clear and more beautiful. And just from that little bit, of stuff. So that was nice. So Duck is always pulling tricks like that on me. Thank you.
I assume, use music, because I've known you can use music, but what's your favorite kind of music to use in some of these, or does it vary with what your expectation is?
Well, first, we like to ask people what they liked about music. And then one of the interesting things, this one we were doing this systematically for 3.5 years, but there are a lot of people that don't like classical music, and they only wanted popular music. And then we'd have them in there and say, why don't you just try a little of this music? And they'd say, okay. So we'd play some classical music, and to a person, they came out of there preferring classical music to ordinary music.
Wow.
See, at first, you know, they didn't like it. And just they wanted jazz and stuff like that.
But, you know, you've had such a wide variety of maybe careers, you know, from engineer to psychedelic to explorer, et cetera. You know, we're making this recording for the people in the psychedelic salon. It's people all over the world, really. They're, you know, kind of sitting there, some feeling all alone, like they're the only ones doing this, or they can't talk to anybody. And you know, I think it's important to know that there are a lot of people out there who are interested in this, and that you've been doing this for over half your adult life. Is there anything that you want to give encouragement or reasons why to do this or why not to do this?
Well, it's a difficult question, you see, because we're here in the United States, and they have outlawed it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't do anything without being an outlaw.
Right.
And so it makes it very difficult. One of the people that we know was creating new things all the time, and we learned a lot from some of those things. But after a while, they shut the whole thing down altogether. And they're really bitter about it. And they don't understand what it's all about, and they think that they're being really proud and working for the government and preventing people from having anything to do with these substances. It's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. Thank God they're wiser in Europe. There's a lot more going on. Well, for a long time in England. I discovered fairly recently that an awful lot of work has continued to go in Holland. They just kept quiet and didn't report anything. All kinds of good stuff is going on there. People in Switzerland are doing more of this kind of work, a little bit in Germany. Now in Israel, I think Rick Doblin has gone over there quite a bit, and he's encouraged them to get started with MDMA. So that's proceeding. So there are breakthroughs, but they're slow, and most of them are distant. And it's just a shame that we can't. Well, there are a few openings showing up in this country. There are three projects that are approved.
Do you have any regrets about the path you've taken with your life?
About what?
About the path you've taken, about leaving the fast rising engineer track to the almost outlaw track.
Well, I don't know. I don't consider that it's an outlaw track. As long as the main thing I have to do is not get caught. So, you know, you have to plan those things carefully and think about it very carefully, and because it can be in jeopardy. So I do my best to totally avoid all of that.
Yeah, just be sensible. You know,
mm-hmm.
Don't be blatant. Do you want to say anything about your say relationship with Timothy Leary and your involvement with Timothy Leary, or do you want to leave that one alone? I don't care.
Well, I don't mind saying, Hubbard went and met Leary, and he liked him a whole lot, and he came back, he wanted me to put Leary on our board of directors, and I wasn't about to do it without meeting him. And after a few months, after Hubbard had been over there, he came to the West Coast, and he came to our place, and I got introduced to him, and I found that he's a very winsome person. He's a very smooth talker, and I made a date with him. He was seeing some people in San Francisco, and so he told me to come up and we'd spend more time together, and he gave me the address of a lady to go to where he was going to see later in the day. And I got there quite a bit before he got there. So I spent some time talking with her. She was a lovely person. She was a nurse, and he had met her, and he's a smooth character. And I think he's really smooth with women. So the three of us went out for dinner, and we talked till close to 1 o'clock in the morning. And just between us and the girl, she must have been very, very bored. But on the other hand, you know, see, I was sitting there with her, and then when he came and knocked on the door, he walked in, he had a suitcase, and he set it down. It was very clear that he was going to spend the night there. So but we enjoyed our dinner, and we enjoyed our talking, and she probably was pretty bored by all the stuff we were doing. I don't know. Anyhow, I went home at 1 o'clock, and he went back with her.
And he made it to the board, I guess.
And he made it to the board, yeah. I liked him. And then a whole bunch of stuff happened, and they said, look, they don't care the way that they're behaving, and if they're going to be on your board, we're not. We're going to resign. So I actually went out there and...
out to Harvard or Cambridge?
Yeah. And
Leary was still at Harvard then.
You know, he was still at Harvard, but the dissension had already gotten risen. And we sat at a big table. I had about 24 people there.
At dinner?
And they were part of his group. I had heard that, you know, that they were going to release him. And somehow the discussion came up, and I brought it up that when's this going to happen? And all the other people said, what do you mean? This is all a bit bullshit. That isn't true. And I said, Tim, is this true or not that you're going to be released? He hadn't told his own people. But, you know, I had him caught, and he said, yeah, this is going to happen.
So that's when they found out?
That's how they found out. If I hadn't been there, God only knows how much longer it would have taken. The next morning, I got up early in the morning, I had to catch a plane. And I told him that we had to take him off. And I couldn't help liking the guy.
How did he take it when you said you're taking him off the board?
Oh, he understood.
Yeah.
He understood. After all, if they can kick him out, I can kick him out, I guess. Yeah, but he's pretty understanding about those things. So.
Did you have any interaction or meeting with him after that, any years later?
Actually, on the way home on the airplane, I realized that I hadn't been real honest with him. And when I got back, I wrote a pretty good letter back to him, and pointing out a number of things that were inappropriate and so on. And very important for me to get back and really state my position very clearly. And I did that.
Did you ever meet him again after that? In person?
I don't think I ever did.
How about Dr. Hoffman? I mean, I've seen pictures of you and Dr. Hoffman. So,
well, I've been there three times. Mm-hmm. And
how did you first meet him? Under what circumstances? When?
The first time I met him, Hubbard was visiting him, and some guys were trying to sell me LSD. And Hubbard wanted me to buy it, and I did. I think I paid $2,000 for some damn thing for it.
How much?
Huh?
How much was it? How much of it?
Oh, it was a bottle full. It wasn't worth anything like that. What I did, with Hubbard's instruction, I took it to Switzerland to be analyzed. So at New York, I was getting... You have to go through a thing... And Hubbard told me, now be sure and tell them that you've got this because you want to bring it back. So I went to these people that they were behind the thing, and I handed it to them, and I didn't tell them about it, and they dropped it on the floor. and splashed all over. Oh, God. But, you know, fortunately, there was enough of it in some pieces of glass that I was able to pour it into something so I could still take it.
You scraped up these drops of LSD and took them to Switzerland?
Yes, I managed to do that. And then I turned it over to Hoffman. And he went and checked it, and he came back, and he says it's unusable.
So, and that was your first meeting with Dr. Hoffman.
Now, when we had the longer day,
first time, that was.
I think that was the first time. Mm-hmm. Then I saw him several times after.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, I understand you talk to him somewhat frequently, and so
pretty much so.
How is he right now? He's approaching 101.
He is approaching 101. He's having a hard time. He still likes to get out and walk, and you know, has to use things to lean on. And they have a beautiful home. They're way up on top of a hill. They didn't know other houses in sight. The beautiful trees, and he actually looked down into France.
Mm.
And he loves the outdoors, and he loves getting out and seeing all those things.
But how's his attitude? Is he still...
He's still very present.
Oh, good.
Very present, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to report that Myron told me he spoke with Dr. Hoffman a week or so ago, and that he's still going strong at 101. And wouldn't it be a perfect world if the great Dr. Albert Hoffman received his well-deserved Nobel Prize before he died? Well, at least we can still dream about a perfect world. Hopefully it won't take as long for the world to recognize the genius of Hoffman and Shulgin as it did for the Catholic Church to admit that Galileo was right about the Earth going around the sun. But that's another story. I'm really glad now that part of the conversation you just heard was about Duncan Blewett, and also that we were able to be talking about him while he was still alive. Because just 2 weeks ago, I received an email from Wooden Ship, who attached an obituary from a Canadian newspaper telling us of Duncan's passing on to his next big adventure. And although I only got to spend a week or so with Duncan and his wonderful wife, June, at a conference in the San Juan Islands a few years ago, it was truly a magical time for me. There's just so much to remember about Dunk, as his friends called him. But the thing I remember best is his smile. In fact, I can't remember ever seeing such a beatific smile as Duncan graced us with all that week. In his autobiographical book, Tantos to Eros, Myron Stolaroff includes a letter that Duncan wrote to Al Hubbard that starts off with the salutation, "Hello, you old goat." And that was pure Duncan, the elf-like psychologist who contributed so much to our understanding of psychedelic medicines at a time before the fascists shut down all the inquiry into these important evolutionary technologies. If the opportunity ever presents itself, I plan on compiling a few remembrances of Duncan from those who knew him. But for now, I'll just pass on a comment that Myron made to me the other day when I phoned and asked him if there was anything he wanted to say to you about his dear friend Dunk. And out of all the stories, books, and papers connected with Duncan Blewett, the one thing Myron thinks is the most important contribution he made is his landmark work titled Handbook for the Therapeutic Use of Lysergic Acid Diethylamide 25 Individual and Group Procedures. Now, whether or not you've ever used LSD, or if you ever intend to try it, this one handbook, according to Myron and almost every other psychedelic researcher I've questioned, is still the single best source of information about the experience and how to manage it, both as a participant and as a sitter. And the complete handbook is available online at aerowid.org, aerowid.org. And I'll try to remember to put a link to it on the program notes for this podcast. Which reminds me that I should probably point out that I've been writing program notes for these podcasts for the last 20 programs or so, and you can find them on our Notes from the Psychedelic Salon blog. And there are links to that blog from several places on our website, and you can also get there directly via www.psychedelicsalon.org. Actually, .com, .net, and .org should all get you there if my redirects are working. And although I haven't had time to go back and prepare detailed notes for some of the past programs, I am very pleased to announce that one of our very own saloners, Bill, who, if I remember correctly, is living in Japan at the moment, has begun working on some of Terrence McKenna's talks and has already sent me some really good detailed program notes for the first two Valley of Novelty podcasts. And I plan on having them posted in the next few days. And by the way, for this blog, I'm using the open source WordPress software, which means that you can also post comments and even original articles on that blog if you want. I'm a little behind in doing this right now, but I do try to send a personal welcome to those of you who have registered to post comments and stories. And I'm hoping that over time that this will become an interactive place for all of us to continue exchanging ideas in cyberdelic space. Well, let's see now. I've fallen so far behind in mentioning some of the items you've been pointing out in your emails, but there are a couple that I need to mention right now, and one came from Rye, who sent a link about the ongoing attacks on Salvia divinorum in California and other places. And the link he sent was from one of the six or more tribes on tribe.net that are focusing on Salvia divinorum. So if you are using salvia in your spiritual practice, you might want to pay close attention to some of these goings-on. And I really have to apologize to John, Robert, Michael, Martin, and Kevin, who during the past 3 weeks have all made donations to help these podcasts stay online, and who I haven't yet had the time to personally write and thank them for their donations. Not only has their generosity ensured that our web hosting fees will continue to be paid, collectively, they've also made it possible for me to finally get a decent microphone, which I plan on doing in the very near future. Gosh, there are several other emails I think would be of interest to you, like some of the ideas Lewis and Joanne sent, but since this podcast is already 2 days late in getting online, I'm going to have to postpone mentioning them until next week. I do want to thank all of you who have written, and I can assure you that your emails are being read as they come in. So, if I haven't mentioned something you brought to my attention, please don't give up on me. My intentions, I assure you, are far better than my follow-through these days. And before I go, I guess I should mention that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 2.5 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click on the link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at matrixmasters.com/podcast. And if you still have questions, just send them to lorenzo@matrixmasters.com. I want to thank my friends Jacques Cordell and Wells of Chateau Hayuk for the use of their music here in the salon, and I hope to be able to give you an update on their new CD in a couple weeks after Jacques stops by the salon for a visit. Well, that's it for today, and hey, thanks again for being here. It's always good to be back in the salon with you. And until next week, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends. Come on.